Listen up, ladies and gentlemen.
This is
Cinemasters
Podcast,
episode 37.
Hello and welcome to episode 37 of the Cinemasters podcast. Today we are discussing favorite documentaries. Jacob's idea, so naturally he's not here. As always, I am Daniel Janes.
I'm Rudy Sue Buck.
I'm Andrew Miller.
And I'm Tyler Grant. Sorry.
Okay.
I'd like to point out that it was my idea, not Jacob's.
Was it?
It was Andrew's idea.
Before we started recording.
I think Jacob was one of the forerunners in voting for this.
I think he heard me once I said he went here.
Oh, I second that.
Well, at least we got the guy who originated the idea. Thank you for being here, Andrew.
No problem. Glad to be here.
We appreciate your commitment. All right, Tyler, why don't you start us off with some trailer action?
All right. What's up, guys? First on the news front, Jim Gordon has been casted, and it is Ben McKenzie. Yes, you heard it right. Ben McKenzie from The O.C. and Southland. He has been chosen to play the infamous Jim Gordon for Fox's new show Gotham, which I think is coming this fall, I believe. So that's pretty cool. The show I'm pretty excited for. I know Rudy's excited for it, for sure. The series will feature a younger version of Bruce Wayne, along with Riddler, Catwoman, and the Joker, and also the Penguin. So it's kind of, I'm hoping that they do what they've been doing, kind of like with Arrow, and kind of take it and go that way, that route, with just like the realism and just the good storylines and everything with this show. Hopefully they don't go Adam West era Batman. Let's hope not. But I mean, I wouldn't mind it. But no, so that's my news. Pretty excited about it. Pretty excited about Batman being on television again.
So is WB involved with the project?
Yes, it's their Warner Bros. Television is producing it, but it's just going to be on Fox.
So the question is, does this mean that it's supposed to, or are they going to try and use this as a gap filler between Batman Begins and Batman Dark Knight? Like, are they going to use
it?
Yeah.
At least not
right
away.
So they're creating a new canon for a series of movies, or to sort of go against the series of movies that was finished less than 5 years ago, while they're also still creating movies potentially in the original movie canon.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. As you say it, yeah, stupid. It's kind of dumb.
Yes.
But although it potentially could be in the same canon, my understanding of it is that it's between the years of him becoming Batman and his parents dying.
Wait, what?
It's
when he's like a punk kid and running around being a criminal, maybe potentially.
Kind of in the sense of it's happening before Batman versus Superman, that canon. Hopefully. Maybe.
My head just exploded a little bit, but that's okay.
I'm definitely
excited for the project.
If I was going to be a dumb asshole, I could say that you could watch it and the series could end with him donning the suit and you can believe that it's the backstory to whatever Batman you want it to be.
Yeah. That is true.
But then they're going to drag it out for 10 seasons after only the first four are good, and then they kind of redeem themselves on season 9 and mostly on 10. Oh, yeah, that was Smallville.
Bitter. Okay, Smallville. Okay.
You sound bitter about something, and I don't know what it is.
I'm finished watching up that series right now. I'm on season 9.
So, my thoughts. Ben McKenzie, I wouldn't lead with he was in the OC. I would say he was in Southland. And he also voiced Bruce Wayne / Batman in Batman Year One.
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Well, you know what? I didn't hate him in the OC. Let's be real. The first season of OC was kind of good. I watched it.
So they've got a guy podcast. Who was the voice of Batman. Now playing.
Shut up. Southland. No, Southland's great, though. Southland is a great show. He. I think he does a really good cop. That's why I think he's going to be a really good James Gordon. So, because technically he's not Commissioner Gordon.
In Jim.
He's an up-and-coming detective. So,
I will say I'm kind of been ruined by Gary Oldman in that I'm going to instinctively watch him and just try to think of link him to Gary Oldman. Like
isn't
I'm
the worst. That Gary Oldman was so good that we'll never look at Jim Gordon the same.
Right.
I mean, Christian Bale, he was okay, but someone else could do it better than him. I don't think anyone will ever beat Gary Oldman at anything, ever.
You bite your tongue about Christian Bale.
I thought he was good. I just think that there's some, like, I believe there's room for improvement. Like, I feel like he is definitely the best representation of Batman / Bruce Wayne that
we have.
I mean,
he's no Val Kilmer.
Or George Clooney, okay?
Better than Clooney. The only person who gets close is Keaton in my book.
Keaton's false. Fantastic.
Adam
Keaton.
West because all the way.
Oh, okay. Well, Adam West, he was the first Batman.
Keaton was an amazing Batman and an okay Bruce Wayne. I think Christian Bale was the first person to be able to pull off both of the parts, which is why he stands out so well for me. But I think that
Christian Bale in Dark Knight was probably the best. Now, Christian Bale and Batman Begins and Dark Knight Rises, I think the Dark Knight was the best of the trilogy. I'm saying it.
That's because everybody
said... that's controversial. You want to back that up?
You are not alone in that statement.
Don't test me now.
All right. We'll get to that conversation somewhere down the line when we talk about Christopher Nolan's Batman trilogy. But that's day is not today, so Andrew, what do you got for us?
All right, well, I would like to think that my news is easily the most joyous news in terms of pure joy and just, what the hell is this? Well, if you're a fan of cinema and the art of film, I would hope that you have seen The Room, which is generally considered to be the worst movie ever made, or at least one of the worst movies ever made.
The best description I've heard is it's the Citizen Kane of bad movies.
That's pretty on point, yeah. I mean, to give a little background if you don't know what this is a movie that – a movie is a very light term I'm using.
This term.
This is a feature-length something that I want to say was – officially released around 2004-2005 in about one or two theaters out in Los Angeles, and it was funded by this anonymous sort of Eastern European man surrounded by mystery. Nobody knows where he's come from. Nobody knows where he got the money to make this movie. But he wrote it, he directed it, he starred in it. It was just this really horrible, horrible movie that for some reason through various celebrity fans like Paul Rudd and David Wayne got shown around to all their friends, and eventually this movie became this sort of cult thing throughout the country where there would be screenings and people would go to the screenings and like throw things at the screen, kind of like Rocky Horror style. They would recite lines, and it became this sort of event to see this movie because of how horrible it was. Well, I mean, I can talk about, if you've seen the movie, it stands up to what everyone says. It is mind-bogglingly bad, to the point where it's incredibly fun to watch all of it because it's just hysterically bad. The second lead in the film, or at least male lead, went off and wrote a little book about the making of the movie. And of all the people in the world, Mr. James Franco, because of course, will be developing it and directing it for feature film about the making of the movie. Not a documentary. He's going to actually make a feature narrative about the making of this film. This has got to be one of the weirdest combinations of people I've ever heard in a movie, which makes me just ecstatic. Because James Franco's weird. The guy from The Room is weird. I'm going to forget his name. He's
Tommy Wiseau.
Thank you, Tommy Wiseau.
And he looks.
I've had the pleasure to see in person, and yes, he's very strange. So I mean, it's just a match made in heaven in terms of weirdness and randomness. So I'm very excited to see this. I don't know if it'll be good, but it's very weird that this movie, The Room, has gotten to a point now that it's going to be a feature-length movie by James Franco, who is in his own way insane.
This is like the best bit of news I've heard all day. And
you didn't know about this?
No, I did not. And it really just is making me smile a lot.
Isn't it great? Yeah, this fantastic. Makes you feel good. Yeah.
I'm with you that I have no idea whether it'll be good or not, but I'm definitely excited for it.
Yeah.
We should get together in one city and drink and watch The Room and make that a commentary episode.
That would be amazing. I've only seen it once. I need to see it again.
I feel like it's kind of like the movie Inside of the Ring where you have to show somebody else. Otherwise, you'll just go crazy.
Yeah, I can totally see that.
I felt that way about this YouTube short called "Eagles Turning People into Horses." And every time I show it to more people, it makes me laugh harder. I'm getting a phone call. Okay.
How dare you, sir?
Someone's popular.
Whoa! Phone's on silent.
Speaking of phone calls, Seth Rogen probably made a phone call to Evan Goldberg when they decided that they were going to write and develop Preacher for AMC. Now, Preacher is a comic book, supposedly very, very good one. I have not read it, but I'm super excited for this show because that means I don't have to read it, but it will also give me an excuse to read it. Yeah, it follows Reverend Jesse Custer, who is a tough Texas preacher who lost his faith and has learned that God has left heaven and abandoned his responsibilities. So he goes on a mission to track God down and get him to get back to work. So yeah, this sounds super intriguing. I think they're trying to make the next Walking Dead phenomenon. If anything were to do it, I think this could do it. It's kind of a similar tone of comic from what I hear, and just incredibly well written.
Yeah, from what I know about it, again, I don't know a lot, but just the overview of it, it's I'm very interested to see it, just to see the tightrope they walk on handling the religious aspects of it. Because it's got to be, I mean, from what I understand, it is incredibly anachronistic against religion. So I'm just curious to see, will they go all the way with that, and like it is in the comic book, or will they try to tone it down? I mean, apparently there's a character in it who's a descendant of Jesus who's retarded and like plays with his own poop.
What?
I've read that.
Oh, Lanta.
So, I mean, there you go. It sounds incredibly interesting. But I'd be very curious to see. It's also important to note that even though they're developing it, I don't think they're going to be showrunners. I think the showrunner is this guy named, I'm going to say it wrong, probably Sam Claflin, who was involved in Breaking Bad. So keep in mind that there is a seasoned veteran who's worked with AMC before who knows what he's doing back there also. So, I don't know. Daniel, did they say what the turnaround's going to be on that? Like how long until they – or is it just – it's just starting?
It's just starting. It's been announced since last November, and they just added Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg onto it.
So it'll probably be about a year and a half to 2 years before we see anything. Yeah.
Anything with traction?
Say what?
Anything with any kind of traction.
Yeah, like any footage. I think I remember Walking Dead being announced, and it took at least a year or a year and a half until there was any footage.
I had enough time to read all the comics at that point before the show started. So
I have some more news I forgot about if you want to hear it.
Yeah, why not?
Just a little snippet. Paul Bettany is going to play Vision in Age of Ultron.
Right, that's true, yeah.
So kind of excited about that. I really like Paul Bettany a lot. I think he's an underrated actor.
Don't we know who's going to be Wasp in Ant-Man 2?
Yes.
It's Evangeline Lilly.
Evangeline Lilly. Yeah, I don't know if that's 100% confirmed, but I thought it was pretty solid.
Yeah.
Well, because it was between her and, I think, Rashida Jones.
Who, and don't get me wrong, I love Rashida Jones, but I don't think that would have been proper.
Yeah.
But,
I think she did great in Desolation of Smog.
Smog.
Yeah, I think from an acting perspective, she's always good. But yeah, Desolation of Smog, the character was just the funny thing is she was in an interview and she said just random, but she was in an interview with Conan and they were talking about Desolation of Smog and she said that when she was first hired, she went to them and she said, "Hey, look, I'm fine with doing the love aspect or whatever, whatever we need to do, but please just one thing I ask, don't put me in a love triangle, because I spent 6 years doing that and it's fine, but I don't want to do it again." And then they were like, "Sure, of course." And then they went and filmed the two movies. And then when they said we're gonna make a third movie, they came back to her and said, "Hey, we're gonna have to."
We're gonna have to do.
Remember when we said no?
Manufacture a love triangle for you.
We were definitely lying about that.
Fantastic. All right, Rudy, what do you got for us?
So, if you made an app that went ridiculously viral and everybody wanted to play it, and you were super, and everybody was super addicted to it, and just by having simple ads in it that didn't even really get in the way, you were making $50,000 a day, I'm sure your first move would also be saying, "Wow, I'm making too much money. I should probably not sell this app anymore." That is apparently what the man who created Flappy Bird has decided to do with his life. Instead of making, what is that, $160 million a year. Oh, no. $1,000? I don't remember. $1.6 million a year is what the math would be. Lots of money. Instead of making lots of money, he has chosen to make no money. And because of that, other people who have phones with Flappy Bird on it are beginning to make lots of money. Apparently, you can buy an iPhone with Flappy Bird installed on it for $1,000. This is ridiculous to me. However, I can understand where they're all coming from because I am addicted to Candy Crush and my dealer is not so gracious as the Flappy Bird. Seriously, if Candy Crush disappeared off the face of the earth tomorrow, I would probably be better for it. And I'm really glad I didn't get into Flappy Bird because I probably would be jonesing for some birds right now.
You can always find me. I sell Flappy Bird.
Oh, Christ. No. I refuse.
The funny thing about Flappy Bird is that from every, actual game site I've looked at, they're all just like, "This game is terrible. This is a terrible, terrible game." I mean,
here's how to play it good.
Yeah, it's nothing about it is that well done.
Just like with Candy Crush, though, because when I first saw people playing Candy Crush, they're like, "You don't want it." I was like, "Why not?" They're like, "Because it's fucking Candy Crush. You don't want it." And I was like, "Nah, maybe I'll just play the first 10 levels or something." I'm sitting on the ranch, which means I'm at the end of the game, which is hard. There are 500 levels, and I'm on the 500th level. I'm on it. So when I read an article that said, "Flappy Bird, if you haven't started playing this game, don't start playing this game," I listened to that advice, and I'm very glad for it. So if you're listening and you don't play Candy Crush yet, please don't.
No, Rudy, your experience sounded like off of Dewey Cox Walk Hard. You don't want none of this stuff.
Yeah, Rudy's like, that's such Rudy's a fun like, movie.
I love that movie. It's really funny. He's like, you don't want none of this stuff. And then he tries it, and he gets hooked. Sorry. Okay, continue.
Every
stay
drug
away
ever.
From Flappy Bird.
Well, you can't even get it anymore.
Unless you have it. So you have to keep it on your phone or it's gone forever.
It is, to me, the best used as what I will deem a toilet game, which is while you're popping one off, popping one off out of your butt. you give a good 15 seconds of play.
If you're dropping a deuce, just say that, please.
Popping one out of your butt.
What up, out of your butt. All right.
Yeah, man. Oh, shit.
That's brilliant.
We have way too much fun. I love it.
And on that note, let's get into our feature presentations. Holy shit.
I see what you did there.
Pun intended.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along. When they gathered around and started talking, Cousin Billy would take me walking. Out through the backyard we go walking. Then he looked into my eyes. Lord knows to my surprise, the only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was. Yes, he was.
All right, Andrew, you're up first.
This is going to be a real left turn here, but let's try it. So we're going to try something different, and our feature is actually going to be talking about our favorite documentaries, which obviously usually we do fiction features here, usually genre involved. So a bit of a change of pace to just go to something completely different and talk about documentaries. We live in a pretty good time for documentaries in that with the technology becoming so cheap and so portable, there's a way, way more documentaries being made by people now than there ever was before. And when you have things like pay-per-view and Netflix, you just get this huge catalog that you can find documentaries on. I think most people have their entire catalog is expanded over because of Netflix. I mean, if you look at before and after Netflix, my guess is people have watched way more documentaries. Just because, you know, most people aren't going to go to their Blockbuster back in the past and rent the documentary. But when you have them all in front of you, you know, you might find something that seems interesting to you and attach yourself to it. But, okay, so we were at, last week when we were figuring this out, we decided to just ask, you know, for each of us to pick our favorite documentary. So when I was thinking about it, there are a couple of my favorites that I can think of off the top of my head. Super Size Me, just because I find it very fun. Bowling for Columbine in terms of actual filmmaking. The Fog of War, which if you know documentaries, Errol Morris is one of the most respected documentarians. Fog of War is a great one. But I settled on Grizzly Man, which is the, I want to say, 2005-2006 documentary by Werner Herzog. If you know who Werner Herzog is, then you've definitely seen this movie because it's considered one of his classics, more recent classics. If you don't know who Werner Herzog is, Werner Herzog is a German director who's been around since the mid-60s to late 60s to now, going between documentary films and very, very strange narrative films. He's considered one of the sort of foreign masters of cinema. He did Agour, Wrath of God, which if you're a film student, you've probably studied at some point. Fitzcarraldo. In terms of English language film, something that you might recognize here. He did Rescue Dawn. If you remember, it was a movie with Christian Bale back in 06, 07, where he played a Vietnam vet. And he did Bad Lieutenant, Port of New Orleans with Nicolas Cage, which came out a couple years ago. But again, he's more known for his foreign films and his documentaries. He's also do any of you guys know who I'm talking about?
Nope.
Werner Herzog.
Yeah, I've heard of him. I mean, I've seen Grizzly Man.
Well, yeah. So if you don't know who this guy is, for God's sakes, go on Wikipedia, look him up. Not just because of his filmmaking talent, because he's an amazing director. He has one of the weirdest backstories and like anecdotes in his life that I've ever heard. His main star in all of his fiction movies was like his best friend, and also they were mortal enemies that tried on numerous occasions to try to kill each other. He once ate a shoe for charity. He jumped into a pile of cacti. He saved Joaquin Phoenix from a burning car. What? He got shot during an interview. These are just some of the stories of this guy's life.
Real stories or like wink, wink?
No, these are all real. Real. Yeah. Well, so take some time to look that up. If you want to start somewhere, just look up Werner Herzog eats a shoe on YouTube and watch him eat a shoe. But he's an extremely eccentric, weird guy. But okay, back to Grizzly Man, what we're actually talking about. Grizzly Man is a documentary from about 05, 06 that Werner Herzog did, and it's about this man named Timothy Treadwell, who for many years lived with bears. He was a very unusual man, not necessarily the best in social situations, and he was fascinated by wildlife and bears, and one day just decided, I want to connect with these bears, and I just want to just live completely out with the bears and try to bond with them. The movie itself uses Werner Herzog. Well, Werner Herzog likes to narrate his movies a lot, but he usually takes it as like a sort of impartial judge. He doesn't really – it's not like Michael Moore who puts himself in and is like, look at me, I'm Michael Moore, I'm here, and is very much a part of the documentary. Werner Herzog just kind of abstractly comments on what's happening. He kind of lets the story speak and the images speak for themselves. And what he does in this documentary is it's a combination of him narrating footage that Timothy Treadwell himself actually shot of himself with the bears, and then splicing that with Werner Herzog interviewing people who knew Timothy. So it's about a 60-40 split between the 60 being just actual footage that Timothy shot just by himself in the middle of the wilderness, nobody around, with him and the bears, and then these interviews. The reason I picked it is because...
I think I've seen this.
Huh?
Listening to you talk about it now, I really do think that the one that I picked was something that my roommate showed me. He was huge into documentaries, and one of the ones was this guy who went out into the middle of nowhere and like, I hear that it went... keep going, but I think I've seen this.
Yeah, I'll bring you in when I'm done. I'm almost done. So the reason I picked this is because Werner Herzog is a master filmmaker, and it's just he has a way of shooting the environment that really gets to this sort of like Tree of Life-esque sort of beauty, but also the horror of the world. He's a very emotional filmmaker sometimes, especially in this movie. It's a very heartfelt depiction of this man who you could easily make a documentary about this guy and it be a complete comedy, because this isn't really spoiling anything because they tell you this in the beginning of the movie, as I recall. But the real Timothy Treadwell, he spends a couple years out there and eventually he dies because he was mauled by a bear to death.
Which is shocking. So, you think to yourself,
yeah.
I go out and spend all my time with bears. However could I have died by being mauled by a bear?
Yeah, right. What a shock. Now, when I remember first hearing about this movie, and somebody told me that, I laughed and I thought, well, that's ridiculous. No shit, he got killed by a bear.
Exactly.
So, you know, this documentary could easily have been a folly and made fun of him. But Herzog does this amazing job of really making you see the inside of this man's head and really empathize with him, even though you still think he's pretty insane. You both understand him critically, but also get where he's coming from. And the reason I picked this is because it's not just about Timothy. It's also about the sort of existential connection that humans have to nature, which Werner Herzog has talked about in many of his movies. And I think the fact that this guy shot his own footage adds this whole other layer of emotion to it that I can't think of any other documentary has. Usually, most documentaries show interviews and show their own footage, and then usually sometimes intersperse that with a little bit of old footage. This movie's mostly just his old footage, so you're really seeing the world from this guy's perspective, and that really creates this crazy sort of transcendent feeling that you have going on this journey of this guy. And I remember I watched it in film school, and it was just one of the most sort of emotional viewing experiences I've ever had. I haven't seen it in a while. I watched some clips of it. I'll just say that you should definitely seek it out. It can be very hard to watch, just because, you know, knowing where the story is going and seeing him sort of come to the fact that he might die, it can be pretty wrenching. But it's a fascinating movie that really leaves an emotional impact on you and really thinks about it really makes you think about, you know, our connection with animals and the sort of angst we have in trying to find some sort of peace in life. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful movie. So that was why it was my pick. It just sort of stood out beyond anything else.
Two quick things, if I remember them correctly. He had, like, a number of successful voyages out into the wilderness with these bears and came back alive every time. Like, he would go out for a long time and then come back and be totally cool. And I think the one where he ended up finally buying the farm, so to speak, if you'll pardon poor taste, was the one where he ended up going out into the wild with his significant other, wife, girlfriend, something, and like something about the way that she couldn't relax around these wild animals is suspected what ended up being the main factor in their deaths.
Right. Yeah. He would go out there for many months in the year and then kind of go and do this really shitty job he didn't like for the rest of the year. And every year he would take longer and longer and longer being in the wilderness until a point where I think he just kind of barely was at his job. And yeah, I believe he kept moving farther and farther into their area. And yes, the last one, he went with his either wife or girlfriend or friend. I don't remember. Some people thought he might have been homosexual. There was sort of an undercurrent about that. No one really knows. He definitely did not have a romantic life. But he takes this woman with him, yeah. And, it's thought that he bringing her in the way that she didn't know how to act and a couple steps that he maybe should not have taken led to his untimely death. But then, and Herzog does definitely mention all of that, but then he kind of counterpoints with, well, but isn't this the natural order that men are just not meant to live with? The movie plays to this polarizing thing where this difference between on one side you have these beautiful, majestic creatures who are pure and live this pure life and love each other in this sort of way that humans can make messy. And then you have this other side that hurts all of them. So it's like, no, they're fucking animals. They're beasts and they will kill you. There's no deeper emotions there. They're just animals. And the movie definitely plays with that sort of which way are you supposed to look at life and us and animals and the environment. Because, you know, it ends up biting him in the ass. And there's this horrifying scene near the end of the movie where you see this one moment where, again, he films himself and by himself, just talking to himself and these bears. And he even says, I see myself dying out here. And he says, if I die by one of these bears, I'm okay with that, because I believe that whatever it is I did it wrong. It's not their fault, and I'll be okay being eaten by them and becoming part of them.
Yeah, so that, I remember hearing that very thing going, what are you saying?
Right.
You're okay then, with dying so long as you get to feed a bear? Right.
But then, but see, he's a complicated guy, because then there's other scenes where the bears almost attack him and he freaks out. So he does not adhere to his own, you know, he definitely does not want, you know, it's a mixed thing. He does not want to die, yeah. But he also doesn't want to blame the bears. I know it's a very layered movie of this, where you about a lot of things. It really explores this guy in multiple ways.
Awesome.
Very interesting.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to checking that one out. All right.
I'm not sure. I don't think it's on Netflix, but you can definitely get it on iTunes. It's a pretty popular documentary.
It was on Netflix for a while, because I'd watched some of it. I think I watched all of it. I think I did. I remember, but yeah, he was a weird guy. He was weird, but yeah, animals.
There's a guy out there right now who I think is known as the Lion Whisperer, who has the same kind of penchant for going out into the African wild and spending time with lions and hyenas and fucking wild animals out there, and they're just chill with him. Like, he's hanging out and he like knows the pride order and who's sort of top of the pecking thing and who's mating with whom, and like it's ridiculous that there are some people who have the ability to sort of impose themselves upon a wilderness social chain.
Yeah, I mean, the guy even like is in awe of their poop. Like, there's a scene where he goes up to the big pile of poop that they made, and he like puts his hands up to it, and he's like, "Oh, I can feel their warmth, and look at all this poop."
This used to be inside of a bear.
Yeah, right. He's just sort of in calculable love with everything about these bears. I mean, mostly because the movie doesn't say anything, like, definitively, but clearly he could not work with humans well. So he found some sort of solace in the animals.
Because he loved the animals.
Specifically grizzlies, which you probably shouldn't love grizzlies.
Yeah. Upsetting for the grizzlies.
Awesome. Rudy, why don't you take yours then?
So, to counterpoint Andrew's, this is a great age for documentaries because everyone's making documentaries. I chose a documentary from the year 1979. It's a documentary that has a narrative, a actual fictional narrative built into it at the end of it all, called F is for Fake. Let's see. Last major film completed by Orson Welles, who co-directed, co-wrote, and starred in the film, initially released in 1974. Sorry, I was totally wrong about that date moments ago. Focuses on Elmir Deori's recounting of his career as a professional art forger. Deori's story serves as a backdrop for a fast-paced, meandering investigation of the nature of authorship and authenticity, as well as the basis of the value of art. Loosely a documentary, the film operates in several different genres, as has been described as a kind of film essay. Far from serving as a traditional documentary on Elmir, the film also incorporates Welles' companion Oha Kodar, a notorious hoax biographer, Clifford Irving, and Orson Welles as himself. In addition to the 85-minute film in 1976, Welles also shot and edited a self-contained 9-minute short, almost entirely composed of original material not found in the main film itself. This is another one where my roommate was sort of watching it while we were both doing homework, and I was listening to it, and there's this moment in it that is just amazing. At the very beginning of the film, Orson Welles comes out and does this sort of pseudo-magic trick for this kid, where he turns a key into money, and then he turns the money into a key, and then he turns the key into a bunch of money, and then he turns the money into a bunny rabbit, and then it all kind of goes to pot from there. But
that sounds. I'm already like so intrigued by the way you described it.
And that's just the introduction. And then he goes in and says, "All right, so now we're actually going to start the movie now. Sorry, it's a study of fakes and fakery, and it questions art and the artist's merit. And at some point in time, like this guy, apparently this guy Elmer is able to create a painting that is so like the painting of the master that even masters that were alive at the time, when they were looking at the painting, were like, oh yes, this is definitely one of mine. But he himself, Elmer, could look at two of them like side by side and pick out which one was his. He was the only person who could really tell which one was his and which one was the real one versus which one was the fake one. It asks a lot of really important questions about the role of the expert and how art authentic art is only valuable because of the person who makes it. But if you can create something that is so like the original that you can't even tell the difference, how is it not also art? And the expert is it unable, if the expert is unable to tell the difference between the fake and the real one, then what's keeping the fake one from being real? And Elmer's question is, if I have a fake Picasso and that fake Picasso hangs in the Detroit Institute of Art and they think it's a Picasso, but it's an Elmer, then am I not an artist? why is being a forger taboo? You know, if I'm creating something that people can look at and derive enjoyment from, then why is that problematic? Now, the thing gets really crazy because at the beginning of the film, Orson Welles says, all right, this is a movie about fakes, fakery, forgery, lies. So, for the next hour, I promise that everything I tell you will be 100% based on our best current facts. I promise that. For 1 hour, I will tell you the truth as best I'm able. The problem is, the movie is 1 hour and 35 minutes long. So he goes through this huge thing of weaving all these tales about this Elmer guy and this other guy who sort of uses him as this clearinghouse. He's making these fakes and then paying him for it and then turning around and selling those fakes for hundreds of thousands of dollars and making millions and millions and millions and just being super rich. And these guys are like not giving him money, but sort of paying for his lifestyle and all of this stuff. And then he tells this story about Pablo Picasso seeing this girl in this villa where he was spending time. And he just like became obsessed with watching this girl come to the beach and from the beach and to the beach and from the beach. And then he, you know, he invites her in and he produces these 28 pictures, but the girl says, you can only paint me if I get to keep all the pictures, to which he agrees. And then they go away and he opens up a new Picasso exhibit and all this stuff is going on. And it's just a whirlwind and you're sitting there just totally sucked into the movie. And then after this scene where they sort of recreate this deathbed dialogue between Pablo Picasso and Elmer, he goes, all right, so remember I told you I wasn't going to lie for an hour? Yeah, I've been lying my ass off for the last 17 minutes because I can. It's past an hour. So this girl doesn't have a father who is Elmer. I don't think he's ever painted anything. But Elmer does exist. And this, some of this stuff really happened, just not the Picasso part. So it's like he sets up all this real life background and sets this fucking brilliant setup, and then at the end of it all he tells this story that you're totally buying into because you've lost track of time, and then goes, no, that's just a story, but why couldn't it be real? And you're like, but and your head explodes. At least that was my experience. So as an artist, it's really cool to watch something like this and think to myself, if you could create something that is as authentic as a real thing, why isn't that as good an art as the real thing? And Orson Welles' voice is just fucking cool. I mean, it is. He even talks about, like, he even goes into his thing. He's like, well, I mean, if we're talking about fakes, I have to be honest here. If we're looking at credentials, because when I was fresh out of college, I was a painter, or at least I thought I was. So I went to Ireland, and I bought a donkey and a cart, and I filled the cart full of paint, and I went across the countryside painting things and giving them to Irish farmers to put me up and feed me for the night. And then at some point in time, I ended up in Dublin and I ran out of money and I sold my donkey and I didn't have any art supplies left. So I told the local theater house that I was a big, important actor from Broadway and they hired me. And that is the beginning of my career. I started at the top and I've been working my way down ever since. and he talks about that. And then he's like, and then right after I got out of Dublin, I went from there being a fake actor to doing huge things in Hollywood, most notably the War of the Worlds, where I created a falsified alien attack, sent people fleeing to the hills for months at a time, and then became a notable Hollywood director because of it. So his entire career is based on being a fake and a forger. It's a fucking cool thing. It's on Hulu. Part of the Criterion Collection, F is for Fake, Orson Welles, brilliant.
You love Scott.
You had Orson Welles. I've never heard of this before.
And, it's his last thing, and it's
other than Transformers.
Unicron.
That's what I was about to say. He has a badass voice. Unicron.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. I've never heard of this. I'll have to check it out. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I'm definitely adding that to my list, or whatever they call it over there on Hulu. Looks fantastic, sounds fantastic. Rudy definitely sold it. So good job.
Thank you very much. And you're welcome, Orson Welles. I mean, he's about 20 years past, but I'm sure he'd be happy to know that this was provocative.
Not to make fun of Orson Welles, but I will. Go online, and if you haven't seen it, watch the video of him, like the outtakes of him and his his Masson wine commercial where he's drunk off his ass. Have you seen that, Rudy?
No.
Oh, God. Oh, yeah, you have to see it. It's like, this, you know, this is in his, like, 70s, 60s, 70s when he's, like, just a has-been. And he has to make money off anything, so he's doing this commercial, and he just keeps drinking the wine. And so they're like, he's like, I do not want to say this. And then they're like, okay, well, you have to say it. He's like, fine. And then he's like, and action. And then they're like, okay, action. And he goes, Masson wine. It's very hard for me to describe, but he's just completely off his rocker and just drunk up his ass.
That's funny. Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide. No escape from reality. Open your eyes, look up to the skies and see.
On a more serious note, Tyler.
Well, on a more serious note, back to animals, especially killer animals. I present to you Blackfish, directed by Gabriella Copperwaite. This came out last year. It was one of the biggest documentaries of the year, one of the most awarded documentaries, or some of them, of the year. And nominated. It takes us on a journey for the notorious killer whale Tilikum, who was first. It's about Tilikum, who is a killer whale. And if you don't know a killer whale, it's an orca. It's those big black and white
Free Willy
whales. Free Willy for those younger listeners. Or older listeners, actually.
Shit, screw you for being 25 or under.
Yeah. You shouldn't be listening to this anyway. And so basically what it is, it's his journey from captivity, to being captured by Sealand, which was a park, I believe in Canada. And he has killed two people. Being in captivity, basically the whole documentary is about how these animals should never have been put in captivity in the first place and never be trained, because they do not work outside of pods as well as people would hope and think. Not like a dolphin would or anything. I mean any animal you take out of the wild and you put it in captivity, and you put it in a small incremental space, and you get, what do you think you're going to get? A happy animal all the time? Basically, I watched this, and I was speechless at some points in this movie, just because I'd heard everything about it. I heard that it's something I have to see. I've always grown up loving orcas, and I think they're just beautiful creatures. But to see this actually in the truth and what actually goes on in SeaWorlds and parks like that, and just it's astonishing. You see these animals. The first person he killed killed a swimmer who was trying to make the U.S. Olympic team, or trying just to get faster. And that was in 1992. I think was the first death that he had, that he committed. And then the second was in 2010 to a woman named Dawn Bertrau, or however her name. And what he did was he basically took her under, ripped off her arm, and she bled to death and died. And the worst thing I think about what SeaWorld and all these people are is saying that it was always the trainer's fault. All these experiences and all this happening and going on. And you have all these researchers and telling them what there was a guy who talked about when he first captured Tilikum, and that he was, what they did was they would throw bombs into the water to separate the babies from the other pods, and then surround them, and then put nets, and just then take them in, and then take them out of the water, trank them, basically, and transport them. And in the process, they killed two whales. And so what they did was they would cut them open, stuff them with anchors and stuff, and just let them go to the bottom of the sea. And just the brutality of all of this, it's something that I think anybody needs to watch who is a fan, who is an animal lover, I guess, or just a humane. I mean, it's just inhumane, the things that you saw in this movie.
Or a people.
Yeah, and it's just, I never want to go to SeaWorld again, probably, after watching this. I'd probably boycott SeaWorld for forever. But it's just to see these majestic creatures put in the situation and to see what they're going through, just, I mean, it hurts. I was left. There was one part where a guy was, one of the whales grabbed his trainer by the foot, took him to the bottom of his tank, and then would let him come back up. And then he would grab him again, take him back to the bottom of the tank, bring him back up. And I was watching this, I go, shit, am I gonna see a guy die right here? And it was just the most intense things I've ever seen, because honestly, I've almost seen a person die in real life. I was at a baseball game a couple years back. at the Rangers game where there was two guys who had fell, who had fallen. I don't know if you guys remember that. People fell from the foul ball and the home run. The one guy who died. But I witnessed a guy fall off after a foul ball. Literally, he fell from the third stands, like the bleacher seats, kind of like behind home plate. I saw him before my eyes. I mean, luckily he survived, but I felt like I was watching that again because this guy was just getting pulled under, and luckily he was a diver, a professionally trained diver, so he was able to withstand the depths and then the breathing apparatuses. But it's just, it's something I think everybody needs to see. It's a great film. It's shot. It's edited together that it really paints a picture on what these amusement parks really do. I mean, I know probably zoos are no better people or into what they do, but I probably will never go to SeaWorld again after it. But has anybody else seen this documentary?
Not yet.
Yeah. What'd you think about it, Andrew?
Yeah, it's great. It's, you know what I mean? It's very well made.
It's important. It gets the points across.
It's a very well made movie. It's pretty efficient. It's not like this. It doesn't really take a lot of time to settle in. It's very fast paced, which is hard to do for a documentary. Yeah, I felt the same way. I definitely turned away a couple times, closed my eyes and looked through my fingers, worrying that I was going to see death or something. Yeah. Something god awful.
Just horrific.
Yeah, because there are. That's not the only one. There are a couple sequences where you just see footage of the show, and then thank God the footage doesn't show anything. You have this feeling like, oh my God, what's coming? The scariest part of that time, and I agree with you, that is the scariest one. That was probably one of the craziest scenes in the movie. Once he finally gets the whale to let go of his foot, he just breaks for the edge of the tank. The way the camera's situated is you see the whale coming after him, like a serial killer. It is frightening. And the whale literally jumps out of the water and tries to grab him and bring him back.
Jesus.
It sounds like I'm really being mean to the whale, but I mean, yeah, the movie does an amazing job of showing you these poor, poor creatures and how they're treated so badly. I mean, they somewhat like Grizzly Man, you know, plays with this idea of can man really tame nature and what relationship we supposed to have with it. And I mean, one of the saddest things to me is that, yeah, SeaWorld keeps arguing like it's the trainers' fault. It's the trainers' fault. These animals are just, you know, they're fine. They love, you know, they're not in pain. They're fine. And there's that one scene where you see video of this mother orca and the mother's baby is taken away from it.
Yeah,
and
that's just brutal to see too. She making the sound that they've never heard before ever from an orca.
Right. They bring all the people at SeaWorld start coming to the management saying, hey, this whale is making a noise I've never heard of. And they even talk like a marine biologist, and they're like, yeah, we've never heard this noise in the wild before. We don't know what this noise is. And SeaWorld just like is like, well, whatever, fuck you. And this whale, it's crying. You see footage of it, and it literally sounds like a person wailing. And this poor mother whale is just cries, and I think it's like for 2 days. It just swims there and just cries. And then for a week later, it just kind of sits in a corner. So clearly it has, like, depression, what humans would easily call depression if another human did it. But the SeaWorld people just completely ignore it.
Yeah, and what's crazy about it is they talk about the brain of an orca and how it has this thing that humans don't even have in their limbic system, I think, emotion. And it's just for something to be like that, it's insane because just to see a mother or just any animal act like that is you never expect it. I mean, you expect it from a human, or something who is capable of feeling those emotions, but never really of an animal to that extent.
Yeah.
Continue. And what else saying is that also these orcas, when they're put together, they're not of the same pod. They're of different whales who have never met each other or don't they have, because all these orcas have different languages. They're not of the same culture.
Right.
They're not of the same pod. And so that's intimidation, and then they dominate. And hence the reason that's why the other whales would rake. What's what the term they use would rake on the other whales, like rake marks.
So. Yeah, the horrible thing also is that SeaWorld, I mean, this is probably the most important documentary of the ones we're talking about, just because this one's actually somewhat affecting social change. I know that there's been a lot of protesters have been bearing down on SeaWorld, and there's been a lot of boycotting. So it's definitely one that actually is really making a difference, or at least getting the information out there.
Yeah. And that's why I really truly enjoy. I mean, I enjoyed the documentary as a point, as an informational, and telling me what I need to know, what I didn't know before. And the only reason they're keeping Tilikum alive or in, like, not in captivity or by himself is because of his semen. He's a breeder.
Right.
Which is kind of depressing as well if you think about it, that, oh, he's killed two people, but, oh, they're going to let it go because he has the best sperm available or the best genetics. And they do a little infographic of how many whales are actually spawned off of Tilikum. So... yeah, I recommend this to go see it, or to see it. It's on Netflix still. I think it's one of the documentaries you need to see, I believe, if you have any love for orcas or anything, or if you love
it. If you have a soul, you need to see this movie.
If you have a soul, you need to see this movie.
That's why I don't want to see it, because it's going to hurt me.
Well, you know, it will hurt, but you'll feel good to watch it. Feel good at the end, I promise.
It'll definitely make it's one of the things where you watch it and it's like, wow, I never thought of it like that, but I was wrong. Like, I've been in SeaWorld, and I never really... it's like I always knew it was bad in the back of my head, but I never really confronted it, and the movie makes you confront it. Like, it's like, oh, wow, the society is doing this.
Yeah.
Screw you, SeaWorld. Happy times.
No, I texted my girlfriend right when I started. I go, this movie's already depressing, because it was the whaler guy, the researcher he was talking about in the beginning. He was talking about how he felt terrible of capturing these whales and doing all. I was just like, God, this is gonna suck. But I'm glad I watched it. I really am.
Sweet. Well, on to a much lighter topic.
please.
My documentary, my options were really between this and Everything or Nothing, which is a James Bond one, because those are the two that I remember the best. I've seen Super Size Me and a whole bunch of other stuff, but not recently enough to really talk about it, and they didn't really stick with me. But the one I am going to talk about is Grant Morrison Talking with Gods. For those not in the know, Grant Morrison is a comic book writer, a very prominent one. He helped change the DC universe. He killed a few people, including Batman, which ended up not being dead. He just kind of went back in time and stuff. Whole different conversation. But yeah, this is a story of his life. Reasons I like this are that, when I first saw it, it came out in 2010. I saw it in 2011 at a graphic arts festival in Sydney, Australia, at the Sydney Opera House. So I paid money to go see this with a bunch of other nerds, essentially. And it was just fascinating. I mean, the mind of Grant Morrison is just incredible. If you've read any of his stuff, then you kind of have an inkling of what's going on in his head. I mean, you don't, because nobody does, because it's just so far out there. This movie follows his life, and it's narrated mostly by Grant Morrison talking about his life, which I think is interesting. I am not a huge fan of somebody telling me a story while there's visuals happening. So when it's a guy talking about his life, that's a little better for me. I think it works better in the form than somebody else just discussing the documentary as it goes. This movie interviews a whole bunch of top comics people. Executive editor of DC Comics, Dan DiDio, is in there. Jeff Johns, who I think is now the chief executive officer. No, he's really high up in DC right now. I think chief creative officer or something. I don't know exactly. But he's in there interviewed. It's just a fascinating look at a fascinating individual. He talks about magic and how he has done magic. And he believes that it works. Fully believes that his magic has worked. And talks to a few other people that he has done magic with and for. And how it has worked for them. Really just a fascinating subject and a fascinating guy. And you of understand where his stories come from, just in his crazy, fucked up little mind and world. Like, everything just kind of makes sense. I don't know. It's a fascinating movie. If you're into comics, you should read it. If you've read anything by Grant Morrison, you should watch it.
What would you say is his best one?
his best work?
Yeah.
Well, I personally like the story where he kills Batman, and called Batman R.I.P. Cleverly. I don't know. He's done a lot. The Arkham Asylum graphic novel is kind of in the golden age of comics, where it helped reinvent the character of Batman, and more so the way you tell stories about Batman.
Wasn't he also, again, I don't know enough about him, but wasn't he also instrumental in reinventing Green Lantern at a certain point? He was very much behind revamping Green
Lantern. Not so much Green Lantern. You're thinking of Jeff Johns.
Okay.
He's the guy who's reinvented a lot of stuff. But Grant Morrison had a really solid run on the Justice League of America in the 90s, the JLA title. There's a lot of good stuff there. It's pretty out there. Animal Man is the guy that he reinvented and made interesting. The Animal Man is his big one that he started in the 90s or late 80s, I guess, and really just made that character. Then the big one that, if you want to read more or learn more about Morrison, is The Invisibles. There's a lot of stuff in that book that comes from his life, and you get to kind of see that in this documentary.
And how old is he now?
That is a very good question. He is, let's see, born in, not telling me.
Well, just generally, I don't really, like, is he older? Okay, yeah, so he's pretty young, yeah.
Yeah. He grew up around in Scotland. He's very Scottish, which adds to the narration. It's pretty awesome. And he grew up like exploring his town with his dad and like spying on nuclear missile silos, because this is like right after World War II. He's led an incredible life. He's done a lot of incredible work, and he's a great writer. And again, just fascinating individual. That's the best word I can use to describe it, because he's just so out there. but you start to believe in magic. Like, you can see just how much he is behind it and how it's worked for him. And you just, like, what if? Like, is that true? Could that be possible?
I was going to ask. I was going to ask you when he was crazy. I was going to ask you, but you answered my question already. I was going to ask, is he like crazy like a fox or crazy like Alan Moore crazy? And then when you said magic, I was like, oh, he's Alan Moore crazy.
But not really, because you're listening to him talk and you're like, he seems like a normal guy.
Like, right.
You could very much have a conversation with him and then get to know him for a year and a half without stumbling across the fact that he believes in magic and he believes he was abducted by aliens at one point in time. Like, it's again, sorry to use this word till it dies, but it's fascinating.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. That's that. It's just a movie that has stuck in my head for the past couple of years. Every once in a while I'll be like, God, that was such a good story and such an interesting life that I got to explore, and just a lot of fun. Definitely worth a watch.
Well, I think we did a pretty good job of picking an eclectic group of movies. I think we did a good job with that. I mean, we got yours, which is the quintessential exploring one man's life. You have the social justice one in Blackfish. You have the more artistic sort of mixing of narrative and fiction, or narrative and realism, and Rudy's. And then you have mine, which is more sort of what happens when a more master filmmaker kind of dips his toes into it. I think we did pretty good in Jacob not included, Jacob. But we did a pretty good job mixing it up.
Yeah, I think if Jacob were here, it would have just felt redundant. Because I don't feel like there's a fifth kind of aspect to documentaries. Right.
Yeah.
Sorry to knock up Jacob a lot this episode, but he's not here to defend himself, so.
Yeah.
All right, let's get into some credits.
Resignation to the end, always the end. So when we found that we could not make sense, well, you said that we would still be friends. But I'll admit that I was glad it was over.
Go for it.
So I was gonna say that my recommendation is not to date grad students because they are always busy all the time and you don't get to spend time with them. And I love Claire and she does a phenomenal job of spending any time that she has with me, but most of the time that time is also taken painting or drawing or otherwise reading homework things. So they're marvelous, they're educated, they're brilliant, and also they are mostly unavailable. But while we were doing this thing on documentaries, I remembered another documentary that I want to suggest for my recommendation, which is a movie called It Might Get Loud about... oh, God, what's the name? I'm going to feel like...
A band called Death? No, that's not it.
No. It's about these three guitarists.
Jack White's one of them, I know that.
Jack White, The Edge from U2, and the lead guitarist from Led Zeppelin, whose name is totally escaping me.
Jimmy Page.
Yes, Jimmy Page, thank you.
Jimmy Page.
And essentially, it's like they put these three guys in a room full of guitars and gear and just let them talk about it. And like each of them sort of goes off on their own thing, where a crew goes and interviews them in their own studios and yada, yada, yada. But it's really, really interesting when they all get together and start gabbing. Like, it shows each of them in this sort of vignette, sort of packing up and getting ready for the day. And Jack White says to the camera, he says, I think my strategy here is I want to go in there and trick these other guys into giving me all of their secrets. but it's just so cool to see them. And, like, they all just sort of riff and jam, and they start playing songs, and they just start sort of picking it up and playing with each other. And at one point in time, Jimmy Page just starts playing the riffs to Black Dog, and Edge and Jack White just put down their guitars and watch.
Jimmy Page is the greatest guitarist
ever. He and some sound engineers invented overdrive, which is the quintessential sound of rock and roll at this point.
Yeah.
He was there. He was there at the forefront of modern rock and roll. And it's amazing to hear him talk about it. Because he's like, we just figured if we could put a little more electricity into it, it made the sound really interesting. It made the sound really kind of rude. And I was like, yeah! So, it might get loud, the
Good Netflix
Stars documentary. I don't know, maybe. I think I watched it on Hulu also. But I'll double check. There's also one out there about the Foo Fighters and their album. Oh god, it was so good. Okay, I'm good. I'm done. I like music documentaries. That's the fifth category.
Gotcha.
All right.
There you go. Yeah, that's true. Concert documentaries. Yeah.
Metallica music, Into the Black.
There we go. The Bieber one.
Well, there's that. The most famous one is probably Gimme Shelter, which is the 70s Rolling Stones documentary about that big show they put on in California where the Hells Angels bikers came and killed somebody. Yeah.
Also, Almost Famous. Yeah.
Almost Famous, yep.
Not technically a documentary, but...
Might as well be.
Good movie.
All right.
Yeah, I guess you could have done a mockumentary. But,
yeah, right. Yeah. Show.
That would be a different podcast, I believe.
Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
All right, okay. Tyler.
All right, speaking of music, a band that I discovered off of their free song on iTunes a couple weeks ago. The band is called Bad Sons, and it's S-U-N-S. They're from Southern California. They have a song... their single called Cardiac Arrest. Maybe Dan can put that in here. Really good band. I like the sound. They just have an EP out for now. It's called Transpose. It's on iTunes. It's like $3.99 for four songs. It's pretty good. Cardiac Arrest. One of my favorite songs on the EP so far. I think they just have a neat sound. We usually suggest some good music on this podcast, so you should definitely heed our suggestions and go listen to it.
I mean, Jacob suggested Lord like a month ago, and then they just got huge.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah, he was churches. A little hipster about that.
Yeah.
He's always been that way. He's always been really good at like, he and my friend Craig would have, like, competitions where he's like... So Fall Out Boy is totally seen right now, but give him 6 months and then they're going to be too big. And I was like, what? I haven't even heard of them. Then like a month later, they're on every radio. And then he was like, you know, do you want to know who's next? Plain White Tees. And I was like, who? What? And then boom, Plain White Tees was huge. And I'm like, how do you two do this?
But, yeah. That's how I feel like with Bastille. They're getting pretty big.
Well,
I know Bastille.
I talked about them. Yeah.
Well, the thing about it is about Lord and Bastille is clearly they're big because we talked about them here.
Obviously.
So
do
we
you
should
know who I knew before they were big?
Who?
Carmen.
San Diego.
San Diego?
No, Carmen with a K.
Yes. Me and Tyler on the same page.
Perfect.
I was listening to them on YouTube, and then now they're on radios and shit all over the place.
I'm proud of you, Rudy.
Yeah. I'm proud of you. Suck it.
Yeah!
Biatch! Okay, I'm done. Sorry. All
right, that is mine, so hopefully Dan could put that song on here.
It'll be here somewhere.
All right, sweet!
My hipster band was Gautier, because when I was in Australia, he started getting really big, and he was actually at that graphic festival that I was at.
And now he's just somebody that you used to know.
Exactly.
What the hell happened to him?
That song got super big, and then I came back to the States, and everyone's like, have you heard Gautier? I was like, dude, so 6 months ago.
Dude, I can't still watch.
And now he is just somebody that we used to know. Because
he had one song on the Gatsby soundtrack, and that's about it.
Yeah,
I haven't heard of him. I haven't heard him since.
Anyways, my recommendations: if you want to read some Grant Morrison stuff, there's his Animal Man run is really good. His new X-Men stuff is pretty out there, but also really good. And check out The Invisibles. But my actual recommendation is a little movie called About Time. Came out last year, little rom-com about this guy whose males and his family can go back in time and kind of relive their lives. And it's just a really, really heartfelt, touching, realistic story. And it's got a great reason behind it, a great meaning to it, a great lesson to be learned, I guess.
Nice message.
Way to put it. It's starring Rachel McAdams as the American chick who's in England.
Oh, that's that movie?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And then the guy who played, I think, Bill Weasley, one of the older Weasleys, Domhnall Gleeson? Sure. And then Bill Nighy as his dad. And so right there, you should be like, yeah, I want to see this because they're all good. And from the creator of Love Actually and Notting Hill, if that wasn't enough.
So where's that one guy then?
That's a very good question.
I mean, Hugh Grant?
Hugh Grant. I was going to say the one who slept with the prostitute, but I don't remember what his name was.
He's not in this movie, sadly.
What?
But yeah, it's just really heartfelt. It's a great romance between him and his wife, girlfriend/wife, and then excellent story between him and his father. And yeah, it's just it twists in ways that you don't necessarily see coming, but you are very poignant. Yeah, I don't know. I can't say enough good things about it. I immediately fell in love with this movie. It was just so good.
Yeah, I've been seeing trailers about that. So, I mean, it looked interesting.
It's on Blu-ray, and it's a very pretty Blu-ray.
I'll have to check that out.
It reminds me, I haven't seen it, but it reminds me of this other rom-com. Or not, I guess it's not really a comedy. A romantic movie called The Time Traveler's Wife, which came out.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't that also star Rachel McAdams?
Yes, it did. Yeah, it did.
And all the things that movie does wrong, this movie does right.
Yeah. I was okay with that movie. There are parts of it I enjoyed. But yeah, I'm curious to see... See About Time.
Yeah, because it's like they literally say like or just ignore how the time travel happens. They don't bother exploring it because it's not important. It's about the ultimate the meaning of the story, the realization that you should live your life like you went back to that day to live that life.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah.
I'm in.
And now for a slightly less serious movie, Andrew.
Which I will be seeing.
Yes. Less serious, but no less good. I have not seen About Time, but I wager my movie against your movie. Because my recommendation this week is The Lego Movie.
Ah!
which is fantastic. Oh, it's so good. Yeah, this movie, I mean, look, what will I have to say about it? If you've been following this movie, I would assume that it started out with you being a movie about Legos. Well, that sounds dumb. And then the directors attached were the directors and writers behind A Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs and 21 Jump Street. And they're like, I really like those guys. That's interesting. And then Chris Pratt got cast along with the rest of the cast. And you're like, that's very interesting. Then you saw the trailer and you're like, this looks delightful. Then the reviews came out, and I believe this movie's rocking a 95% on Rotten Tomatoes right now. And it's just like almost universally beloved. Everyone has been gaga over it. And it really is. It's fantastic. It's a very, very good, very, very new animated movie. And that it feels like nothing you've really ever seen before in terms of animation, both visually and storytelling-wise. Just came out this week, made second highest-grossing movie of February ever, right behind Passion of the Christ, which really pissed me off because I thought it'd be hilarious if it beat Passion of the Christ, because Fox News has been, like, making fun of the Lego – not making fun of the Lego movie, criticizing it, saying it's against capitalism. So I thought it would make a whole other funny thing if it also beat Jesus. But that didn't happen. But it was close. But, I mean, this movie is so not for kids, though. Kids will enjoy it also. It's got, like – it's almost like Arrested Development in that there are jokes buried in jokes buried in jokes the entire running time. And it has layers to it in terms of, like, what the film is actually about, what the themes are. It manages to be both very heartfelt – and also be very sardonic and very critical of things that most kids' movies take for granted and even films take for granted. And I won't spoil it, but it goes without saying that this is, in a very odd way, a mind-bending movie. It has turns in it that I really did not see coming and that have very successfully been completely unshown in the trailers. But trust me, it's the kind of thing where, like, if you go to see the movie, you come out of it and you're like, what about that part? That was crazy. So it's an incredibly inventive movie that's just incredibly enjoyable, hysterically funny, and also, by the end of it, very moving. And again, like you were saying with About Time, it has a very, very strong message behind it. And it really, you know, it's just a wonderful time that also makes you sort of think, wow, you know, why can't all these kids' movies be this inventive and this smart about what they're trying to do? So I suggest everyone go see that movie now, right now, everyone of any age.
On Friday.
Yeah.
That is what's happening.
I would, but my only person who I go see movies with is, unfortunately, in grad school.
Well, Valentine's, is it a good, would it be a good date movie?
No.
Well, I don't care.
Well,
we're seeing it anyway.
Date is in, like, trying to get laid date, or date is in, oh, hey, we'll enjoy this.
No, it's my girlfriend. I'm just dating.
Oh, okay. Well, just if it's girl, sure. I mean, yeah, it's the light. Yeah, you'll both walk out of it really happy and smiling. Then, yeah.
That's what I wanted to know.
I wouldn't take, like, a first date. I mean, like...
No, I'm not dating anybody else. No.
Somewhere on the internet, there is an article about how Finding Nemo is the best first date movie.
That's ridiculous.
How? Read it. How so?
Psychologically, it is a panty dropper.
You mean the one where his wife dies in the first 5 minutes?
His wife dies from a horrible death by a serial killer, and then his son is paralyzed or handicapped and then stolen.
I would love, though, if we all end up seeing the Lego movie at some point to talk about it on another podcast, just because there are things that happen in it that need to be talked about, or just layer, you know. I want to talk about it, damn it.
Well, Friday. Right. I'll be seeing it Friday.
We'll make that happen.
Rudy, go watch it.
All right, I'm going to have to go by myself. It's going to suck.
Dan, have you seen it?
Not yet. I saw Labor Day instead. probably should have seen that Lego movie.
I wanted it to be good.
Yeah, that we'll talk about that later as well. Until then, though, thank you for listening. If you want to leave us some feedback, you can do so over at thecinemasters.blogspot.com or by sending us an email at thecinemasters@gmail.com. At that blogspot page, you can also find links to our other podcasts, the Mainframe Chronicle podcast, the Rogue Arrow podcast, and the Coulson Lives podcast. Yeah, like us on Facebook, rate, review us on iTunes, spread the word. And the word is the bird. The bird is the word.
Bird, bird, bird. Bird, is the word. Bird, bird, bird. Bird, bird, is the word. Bird, 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 bird.
Grab this on yourself, Daniel.
As always, I am Daniel James.
I'm Rudy Schuback.
I'm Andrew Miller.
And I'm Tyler Crouch.
My accent didn't make it through the episode. I apologize.
It's okay. It's all right. And that was a podcast.
Yes, it was.
The Cinemasters podcast is an Autologic Cool Media Productions podcast. You can leave us feedback at thecinemasters.blogspot.com or send us an email at thecinemasters@gmail.com. Please rate and review us on iTunes and like us on Facebook, and go over to almppodcasts.blogspot.com to check out our other shows. As always, thank you for listening.
I like it.
I know, it's great, right?
Another!
Bye-bye, boys!
Have fun storming the castle!
Think it'll work?
It would take a miracle.
Bye-bye!
Everything is awesome! Everything is cool when you're part of a team! Everything is awesome! When we live in our dream! Everything is better when we stick together! Side by side, you and I, gonna win forever! Let's party forever! We're the same, I'm like you, you're like me! We're all working in harmony!
My body in chocolate frosting. 3 years later, I shot the frosting. Smelling like a blossom. Everything is awesome. Every month, got new brown shoes.